Hi, welcome everyone. Today we are speaking with Louis Bacaj. And Louis worked in small companies, startup, and he worked in big companies. He worked in Bank of America, Jet.com, and last he was working in Walmart. And he just recently left Walmart to start his own, and his company name is Nine. First time I come to know about Louis through Twitter. And I saw his tweets, and it was so impressive. And I asked Louis that if he can come and speak to our audience who are aspiring technical devs and who wants to climb up in their professional journey. And fortunately, he agreed, and he said, yeah, he will come over and speak with me. So thank you, Louis. Thank you. And he just completed a course also, which is called Timeless Career Advice for Software Engineers. I bought that course yesterday and listened to it. It's really, really a good course. And I will encourage everybody to just go and buy it. I think it's $25. So before we get into interview, I want to ask you, where did you do your schooling? And where did you study it, and how did you come to America? So let's start from there.
Sure.
From
your so I'm originally from Albania. You know, Albania was a communist country, and you know, I won't get too much into that. Mm-hmm. But I feel fortunate to have seen communism in my young life because it gives you a perspective about the world that I think is really unique. And I was brought over to the Bronx, New York City. When I was 10 years old, basically my family left Albania and I was brought over. And, you know, we grew up in a pretty poor neighborhood in the Bronx. So Albania was poor, the Bronx was poor. And I worked most of my young life. I mean, basically since I was allowed to work, like 14 years old, working in a restaurant as a busboy and things like that. So I had this strong work ethic the whole time. Put myself through college. I paid for it through the restaurant, and then finally managed to sort of start my career around 2010 as a software engineer, pretty much that's sort of my early days. I don't know if that answers your question, but
very, very impressive that you started from restaurants and climb up your own way, and paid for your own studies, and you ended up here. I think I heard in your course that you were talking about when you were leaving Walmart, you are making almost $1 million. And that's a pretty big amount. To reach there, it's really remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, no, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing where I posted this on Twitter, but I was basically making $20,000 a year in 2010. And then by 2020, I actually posted my pay stub on there. I was making $500,000. And then, so that's a 25x increase. And technology lifted my entire family out of poverty. I mean, I love tech. You know, I think it's incredibly, it's a powerful force right now that's lifting, people that want to work hard and study the right stuff. It's lifting them out of poverty. And globally, it's not even just in the U.S., right? And so it's a really powerful force. I'm very grateful for it, and when I walked away from Walmart, I mean, to be able to walk away from that kind of money, like I would have never imagined that from where I come from, to have the courage to do that, but I always had a dream of entrepreneurship. The only reason why I couldn't start my own thing is because I had no money. I felt fearful. I have kids. I have a wife, and so I didn't want to just cut loose without building up some kind of nest egg. And so it felt right by 2021. It felt like the world sort of had tons of problems. I mean, if you just look around, right, there's like immense problems to be solved. Cool. And so I just said, let me just try, let me get out there and figure it out. And that's what I did. I walked away from it. And most of that money was equity, basically, that was vesting because I was promoted so many times. And a lot of it was vesting on a lagging basis. And so, I mean, I pulled the trigger. I did it. And I'm proud of myself, even though I'm scared. I got to be honest with you. I told my bosses that I might be begging for a job if this doesn't work out. But, I'm sure I'll be able to land something somewhere. But basically, I took the plunge. And so, yeah, I walked away from it.
Awesome. So I know, as I was just telling the audience, that I heard your career advice for software engineers. I'm going to ask a lot of questions on that. But I would like to start with because on your when you left Walmart, you are pretty senior there, and you are managing a lot of devs and teams. So my first question is, what does leadership mean to you? And then I have one follow-up question, because you were just talking about being fearless. So the other follow-up is, how one can become a fearless leader? So it's a two-part question.
No, that's a, that's
what
a good
does
question.
Leadership mean to you?
I mean, you know, basically to me, leadership is about being in the front lines, in the trenches with people, not just being in the back, sort of commanding, or from a ivory tower, or from a place of that nature. And so I basically view it as this. You go on this journey with these people, and you're there to help them. Basically, whatever it takes to unblock them, to help them get ahead, to help them propel their career. And so I view it more like a service. I mean, it's not really like the way people think of leadership is like, well, you're going to tell people what to do. I mean, that's a terrible strategy for leading people. And so I never sort of took that approach. I think it worked out really well for me, because a lot of my people stuck with me even post acquisition from Jet. So Walmart bought Jet, and a lot of those people stuck with me the entire time. I'm incredibly grateful, because we learned and we grew together, and we had this immense trust for each other. And so that was really powerful. But I think that comes from basically not treating leadership like something you just tell people what to do. I mean, you're there to help them basically and serve them. So that's how I sort of view it, if that makes sense.
Sure. And the part of where, so this question came from internet to me, that to ask you, how one can become fearless leader.
So I basically think it's pretty much about building courage slowly, right? Like, I don't think anybody is sort of born fearless. I don't consider myself fearless, but being able to walk away from $1 million almost when you come from poverty, it takes some courage. I mean, it's not like, but I didn't get to that. I would have never done that in 2015 or whatever. It's just a lot of steps, right? And so I think basically it's a number of things that make people more courageous. And I think it's trust in other people too, like seeing that, hey, you're there to help these people. You got to be fearless for these people. You can't just if you have to have a fight with somebody else, and I don't mean like a physical fight, I mean like, somebody needs to be promoted, and there's going to be an argument about the merits of this individual or that individual. I mean, that's when you have to have your courage. You have to fight for your people. I mean, that's what you're there for. And so it's just step after step, and sort of fight after fight, if you will, and then seeing that you're not just doing it for yourself. I mean, you got all these other people that are kind of depending on you to do the right thing. I think that's sort of what I'd say helps a lot of people build up courage. And I think it's just basically a lot of baby steps, a lot of iterations, and then eventually, just sort of trusting that you're doing this for other people. You're not just doing it for yourself. I think if you go in there just trying to do it for yourself, it's really challenging, because almost no one can do that. I mean, I don't know. Maybe someone can, but I don't know anyone that can. I find my courage from even with my family, right? Like when I think about when I think about walking away from all this stuff, like I couldn't do it until I had set them up, right? I couldn't do it until I felt like, hey, we've saved enough that now I can quit my job and chase entrepreneurship. So if I look at all of that, it's basically about thinking: have I set other people up enough? If I have, okay, now, I could take the next step, which is a little bit more courage for the next step, but that's how you kind of build it up, I think.
Sure, okay. So, Louis, I know you were managing some big teams. So one question I have: how you keep the team self-motivated and to better and take ownership of things, especially now in this environment where everybody is remote? Do you have any tips on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, so I think basically ownership is sort of everything for engineers. And when they have it, they come alive. It's like when you own something and you feel like you have, and so that means a number of things, right? That means that, you've got to set up your teams in such a way that they own the stuff that they build. If they're kind of handing off the stuff to another team in some other place, and they don't get woken up in the middle of the night when there's no sense of urgency for any of the code that's getting pushed out, then I think it's really hard, because they don't have ownership, and it's hard to be motivated about something that you're never even gonna be held accountable for. And so I think ownership is, you know, something that people take pride in, and having that is really sort of a big deal. What it sort of comes down to is just basically people owning the stuff that they build, and I think that leads to a lot of, you know, a lot of motivation for people to take pride in it. Because if, and also thinking about it like a team owning it versus an individual, right? Like if a group of people own something and you write a piece of code that has a bug in it and ends up waking your colleague up, I mean, that sort of guaranteed the next, when you go in to work and you do the RCA, the root cause analysis for what went wrong, guaranteed you're not going to make that mistake again, right? Because you woke your colleague up. And so, and so I think it's about kind of being hands off, trusting a little bit and giving people ownership, right? Which also means, like, for a lot of managers, it's hard to do that, right? But you have to trust that. You have to also kind of let people make mistakes, right? And so you have to trust that they're going to do the right thing. And I think that's part of it. And managers that kind of just start out tend to be super micromanagey, you know, want to approve every line of code, nitpick about things. And so I think that leads to a lack of ownership. I think that leads to people not being as engaged and motivated because they don't even feel like it's their stuff anymore. They feel like someone's going to come in and just kind of take this away from me or tell me it's completely wrong, right? But I think that's a big deal. Is basically that trust leads to, and again, there will be some mistakes, but I think it's really important that people go through those phases, if that makes sense.
No, this is a very good advice. That have a trust in your team, and as you said, the new managers often make this mistake. They want to be everywhere and they want to manage everything. And for sure, I made this mistake earlier in my career.
We all do, right? So, like when we're first thrust into the job. I mean, that's, you know.
True, exactly. So, no, I think it is very important. I hope people learn from this that to keep team motivated, it is to show the trust and give them the ownership. So this is a very important point. And so now, if you see today's day and time, this remote culture, and organizations are struggling all around, all across US at least, to retain their employees. And I'm wondering if you thought about what companies can do or managers can do to keep not only team self-motivated, but reduce the attrition also.
So this is really tough right now because there's so much attrition that it kind of becomes almost like a cascading effect that you basically cannot, it's really hard to stop it. It's like if you have an open wound and you're gushing out so much blood, it's so hard to get somebody into a healthy state if that's happening. And so I kind of feel like, the biggest thing by far is just to make sure that, people are sort of engaged and they care about their jobs and all these other things. But I kind of feel like that, that basically comes from, a couple of things. And I see a lot of companies trying to offer more money and different ways to kind of incentivize people. And I think that's helpful, right? But like, I think people work together, you know, they want to be in an environment where they feel like it's a safe environment, where they feel like they have ownership and they feel like they're working with other smart people. And so if you bleed out too many smart people, then suddenly like it's this cascading effect. Like, what am I going to do here? I can't even learn anything anymore. And so I think that's a really bad place to be. And I've seen teams, you know, so as a leader of any team, you kind of have to keep an eye on that. Like you have to work really hard to prevent that. And I think part of it is, again, making sure you have a lot of smart people in the team, making sure you have some of these core principles down about how you run the team. I think that's really, really important. I mean, like the trust, the transparency. I used to also use fairness as one of our sort of core principles, and you know, that meant something to us, and it was a way that we did things. Like, even when we made an offer, we were consistent with some of our stuff because we wanted to be fair, and you know, those things go a long way. I mean, it sounds silly maybe, or it sounds cliche, but it's like it goes a really long way, and if you can retain the density of the talent, then I think you prevent the bleeding and you can make it through this phase, you know. But and obviously you're going to lose some people, right? But as long as you're replacing them with other smart people, you keep a high bar. I think the challenge again is if it goes off on the deep end, then it's like good luck. I mean, it's like you're gonna spend a lot of time rebuilding that team from the ground up.
True. And you said the word trust, and that's the one thing I think is very important for a team to be successful. How one establishes the trust in the team, especially in this remote environment, establishing trust can be very tricky.
No, it's true, right? Like, and I think number one, you've got to have some, you know, core principles. And for me, for our teams, trust was one of those core fundamental principles to the team. And it was built up by many other principles. I mean, you mentioned transparency, right? Like, if you're always in transparency is very different than honesty, right? Like, if somebody is just honest with you, that they could be withholding information, they're still honest with you, right? They just, you know, as long as they're not telling a lie, and you know, they're not telling you about all this other stuff, they're still honest, right? And so, right. And so that's, I think, transparency is a very different thing. Transparency is like, I'm putting all the cards on the table. I'm trusting you as an adult. I'm giving you all the information. I'm giving you all the dashboards. You could see the financials. You could see everything. You could see our plans for the next year. You could see how many we're gonna hire. You could see our roadmap. You could see all this stuff, right? I'm trusting you not to like leak it. I'm trusting you not to do all these things. And it also comes down to, like, you know, it's like a two-way street, right? Like you place a lot of trust in people, and then you see how they react, and you see what they do, and you see how transparent you can be, and all those other things. But I think it's like fundamental. You got to have these core sort of principles, if that makes sense. And I think, you know, there's other things too, right? Like I mentioned, I touched on fairness a little bit, but like people seeing that you're fair and consistent, that leads to a ton of trust, right? Like, for example, if we were hiring a junior engineer right out of college, you know, we would put out the same kind of offer. Let's say it was the E2 offer, or you know, every company has different titles, but we were consistent with those offers. Why? They have no experience, right? So they come in, you get two candidates. One is stellar on the whiteboard, another one does okay. And so, but to us, it's either a yes or no. There's no like, oh, he did so good, so we're going to give him an E3. That just destroys trust. Like, why would I trust this team now that they just hired somebody right next to me that is a higher level than me, and basically, you know, they're making more money than me, and we have the same experience. We just got out of college, right? So there's little things like that leaders do all the time, because they see something and it's like a shiny object and they really want it, and then boom, you created this inconsistency, you created this imbalance, you created this like lack of trust in the team. So it's like, if you run it with these core principles, then you kind of avoid those things happening at all. And I think that's like so important, basically. And okay. I mean, it sounds cliche, but like, if you live that stuff and if you do it, there's nothing cliche about it. People know you mean it, like, you know, and I think that's like, that's the key, basically, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So Louis, I have a sure. two-part sure. question again. This question is, first part is, you know, you are starting your career, you are a dev, and you are doing well. So what are things they can do to get promoted to next level, become a dev lead, which is I calling M1, like managers or developers. And the second part is what they should do or unlearn to become M2, where they are managers of managers. So first part is, from dev to dev lead, and then from dev lead to dev manager.
Yeah. So basically, let's touch on the first one. I think so. One thing that I found is, that progression from, I start out as an individual contributor. Let's say as I start out as a junior, everyone has to start out as a junior, and you got to go through kind of the hoops, and then eventually you become senior enough that people trust you to make big decisions, right? Like, they trust you to either manage people or they trust you to make big architectural decisions. We're sort of fortunate in our industry that you could do either one and make a lot of money. We had even at Walmart, right? Like, definitely a jet, but like at Walmart, we had like architects that were making more money than me, a senior director, right? But and so you have to sort of allow right. for that career progression in these companies. It's very important. And basically, once you get to like a certain level in your career, you can make this kind of decision. Now, how do you become a people manager and versus an architect? I mean, so in my teams, and we were very fortunate. We got to play around and try these things out. These are very different jobs. And so what we did is we sort of, with a lot of handholding, let someone trial the manager path, if you will. And when mid-year conversation happened or end of year conversation, I was in the room with them and the individual just to make sure that everything's going well and just like, you know, helping them out, right? Not in a sense like trying to do the mid-year conversation, but if any like really tough questions come up, I could be there. So having a place where you could do that transition safely is like really important, because if you become a manager and you find out you're bad at it, then what? Then you got to like quit your job and go somewhere else, you know? And so you have to be in a place where you could ease off in one direction or the other. And frankly, I mean, if I look at my own career, I've sort of veered a little bit on both sides, right? Like I still build stuff. And so I've kept a lot of my tech skills sharp. And I think what happens is a lot of people move into this management path and they completely lose their tech skills. And then it makes it really hard and they kind of get stuck because they can't go and pass an interview somewhere else. And they can't, you know, and a lot of these higher tech organizations, they require you to have basic data structures and algorithms and also basic design skills, especially like if you're a manager, you have to know what the team's talking about when they present you an architecture or whatever it is. So those things I think are like really important, having like a safe way to transition. So I'd say if your goal is to trial the manager path, find a good place where you could do that and make sure you talk to your manager and make sure you partner up with your manager that they can help you. And I know this sounds like scary because the manager might say, oh, but it sort of behooves the manager too, right? Like it's going to help them a lot because now they're going to be able to offload 5 or 6 reports or 10 reports under this person over time. And they're going to get to grow their team into multiple teams. And so if you bring that up to them and you have that conversation, you say, look, I want to take over as my goal is to become a manager. Can you help me? Can you handhold me? Can we do these reviews with these people? Together? And if I like it, you could step out of the room. If I hate it, I'd like to maybe go into the architect path. And just have those conversations. I think having that environment is so important. We kind of set that up. And then I think basically going to the next level, which is now we're talking about a manager of managers, I think that's a very sort of different thing, right? And basically, as you kind of going into like middle management, which is what it is at a lot of big companies, and now you run multiple teams and you're more in charge of, you know, kind of strategy and direction and really tough people stuff. Like you've got to, you know, somebody has to go on a PIP or whatever. Like, you know, it kind of cascades into nothing but people stuff as you kind of go into those N1 or N2, right? And so you have to really love people stuff. And if your goal is to help people get ahead and do that, then I think, you know, it's a wise move to go in that direction, because I mean, as you know, you got to keep growing, right? So you can't, I mean, you've kind of become a manager now, and you either go to manage multiple teams or you step back and you become an architect and go down that path, right? But you can't kind of, it's kind of hard to do both, because you've got to build up these skill sets. And what it means on the management side is like you've got to see a lot of different situations. I mean, you're gonna have to go through some tough stuff, like even letting somebody go. I mean, that's a really difficult thing. And I seen CEOs mess that up, you know. And so it's like, yeah, I mean, that was, oh, yeah. You know. So my point is, as you're kind of progressing up these paths, you got to have a strong intuition and gut that's what you want to do. And if you do, then you double down and you learn those things. You read books on it. You do whatever it takes to pick up that skill set. You find mentors that are there and you have them, like, you know, coach you through different circumstances, different things that they've gone through. So basically, I think, you know, we're very fortunate in an industry. You don't even need to go down that path to make a lot of money. And there are CTOs at startups and even bigger companies that don't have a lot of reports. I mean, they just set the strategy and they don't have 1,000 reports that they do one-on-ones with. It's you know, and so I think you can go really high up basically on either track, make a lot of money if that's your goal, but you should pick the one you love the most. And I think once you kind of know that that's the one you love the most, you want to do your research, you want to find mentors, you want to find people that are going to help you every step of the way, basically. I don't know if that kind of answers your question, but that's how I see it progressing, if that makes sense.
It does. So, Louis, I have a second question, which I faced a lot of problem fixing this issue was, I was in Microsoft, and then I left and went to a startup. So that startup was, you know, pretty big as such. It's not very small. My team was about 100 devs. And the problem there I was struggling with was making the vision flow down all the way. Because I see the leaders generally get successful, or the companies, because they build the product where they have this vision, which is somebody on top maybe thinking or coming up with the idea of a product or, you know, services. And I see some big companies do this very well, like Microsoft, Google, Amazon. They build so complex products, but somehow the vision they have, the leaders who have this vision, that vision flows down and to the lowest level of devs and, you know, tester, everybody gets that vision. And I know Walmart, it's a pretty complex business. And I wonder, as a leader, do you do something or, you know, what all you do to make sure that your vision flows down all the way to every dev or test and DevOps guy?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think this is a really complex question, obviously, and this is not an easy thing to sort of execute, and there's a lot of factors, right? Like, company culture, right, comes to mind as one massive factor. You know, what's the culture of the company, and all those things. And so, I mean, I think the way that I've sort of done it, I've spelled it out, right? Like, I've literally written it down on a Confluence page, and I've taken the time to sort of write down our core principles as a team, and also write our vision, right? Which is like, for a jet, it was to kind of build, the large scale distributed systems that can power marketing and personalization for jet at scale. And, you know, we wrote stuff like that. And what does that mean? And I got more granular. And basically, people can go and read that, right? But then also, I mean, you have to kind of push people that are one level below you, and all the people that you have with and that you have one-on-ones with, you have to push them to understand the business, right? Because what happens is, a lot of the times on the tech side, the disconnect is not necessarily like that grand vision. The disconnect is like with their business partners, almost at least is what I've found. You know, I mean, it could be different, and like I said, there's so many factors here. This is really difficult to pinpoint. But like, basically, creating that culture where people, want to partner up with their business partners, want to understand the business partner. I think part of creating that is like asking people in the one-on-one, like, hey, you know, that feature you pushed out, what was this. You know, what move? Did the needle move on the sales? Did conversion change? You know, these kinds of things, right? Then that causes them to go probe, because a lot of times people don't even think about that, right? Like, and they push the feature and everything's working. And, you know, if they look at the telemetry, there's no downtime. It's all good, right? But they have no idea how much it sold. That is so important because going back, it's like it ties into this grander thing of like, what are we even doing here? Like, why are we even building this stuff? And so I think basically I don't know if I exactly answered your question, but I think that kind of leads people into digging deeper, finding out what these things are, and then maybe even going and pinging their business partner and saying, hey, can you show me the dashboard for the GMV, for the sales numbers, for the conversion, because my, you know, I need to know now, and I need to keep tabs on it. And then to further reinforce this, especially like the higher level you go, you incentivize it, right? Like, you incentivize. I mean, you know, Warren Buffett, I mean, didn't say, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome for no reason. It's basically like, if you incentivize that, if you say, hey, the person that's getting promoted is the person that added the most GMV, that's it. I mean, they're going to know exactly what the GMV is. You'll never have that. And I know that's a right. silly metric. Like, I'm not saying, you know, because there are people that work in DevOps and other groups that don't move the needle on the GMV, but they move the needle on something. They have customers, right? Like, the other engineers are their customers. And so start there, right? And so right. So I think you, as a leader, you have these levers that kind of force people to do their own research to the vision. I mean, obviously you got to spell it out. Obviously you got to lay it down somewhere. But I do think you kind of want the incentives to tie back to that. Otherwise, people will just divert because, you know, let's be real. I mean, we're engineers and we love technology. So it's very easy to just fall in love with that and do a really great job with that. But that might not be increasing sales at all. That might, and let's be real, like if we don't have sales coming in, none of us would have the job. So it's like this kind of, you know, I think there's basically many levers we can use to bring people back to the vision. True. And it's not like a forceful thing, right? Like you're not going to be able to just tell people, this is the vision and I want you to pay attention to it all the time. And if you don't, like, whatever, you know, I think there's a lot of things you could do on a regular basis and people kind of, then they internalize it and then you don't have to tell them. I mean, they'll tell you then, right? Like they'll just, you know, if it's baked into the cold, they'll tell you, right? And then you'll be surprised. Like, my God, like the numbers move that much. That's amazing. You know?
True. No, I think it's a very important thing you said, which I've seen a lot of people miss that part about writing it and communicating that vision. So because when you're writing, it becomes crystal clear. And I think as a leader, your main job is to bring the clarity. Like, where are we heading and where will be our future 5 years or 3 years from now? That's the job of leader. And if you write it and then you connect it with all the other initiative and matrices,
and you're also going to have to say it a lot too, Rafat. Like you might find yourself sounding like a tape stuck on repeat or something because you're going to be in different meetings and saying the same thing again and again and again. And it's like, that's what people need. I mean, they need to hear that again and again. And then it's drilled in that like, this is what we're going after, you know? And so you sound like you're parroting a little bit, but I do think it's very important. So yeah.
It's very important. Yeah, I agree with that. Cool. So next question I have, Louis, I'm sure you hired a lot of people in your career in different companies. And so what I want to know for when you are hiring, what you look in the candidate? And of course, everybody will say, you know, they look for IQ and smartness and all those things. So my question is a little deeper than that. What you look in candidate? And how you can find out all this in an hour, really, because you have just an hour time with the candidate.
It's really hard, right? Like, hiring is one of the most difficult things in our industry, and for a number of reasons. And I know people think they've got it figured out, right? They don't have it figured out. I mean, you know, we had a very, very high bar as a team, both at Jet and Walmart, in terms of the engineers coming in, at least in my teams, you know, because I, like, going back to the initial earlier point that I made, is like, if you don't have good people in there, that you know, that kind of leads to all sorts of problems. And so we have a very high bar in terms of hiring, but it's not in the way you would think. I mean, it's basically like a strong work ethic. It's like are they a good teammate, a good human being? Are they, and those things like are completely ignored in our interview process, basically. I think we focus a lot on the whiteboard, which is important. Like, you're there to code, and so we need to know that you can at least code. But I think that misses out on basically the 90% of the stuff that's going to make somebody a good teammate. And so for me, so all of our interviews that we did in all these places, we tested for, you know, data structures and algorithms and basically all the fundamentals, right? But also, you know, the more senior they were, a lot of you know, different design patterns and architectures and different things for scale or whatever, what have you, right? So we tested for all of that. But then when I would talk to people, I would ask a very basic programming question just to see that they could program. And that's it. Then the rest of the conversation would just be about the people stuff. Like, I would flat out ask, like, tell me about, you know, something that tell me about your work ethic, you know, just like that, right? And let's see where they go with it, you know. I would look at things that, you know, I mean, you'd be surprised. Like, a lot of people go to great lengths to put projects up on GitHub, write essays, make all these external contributions. And I mean, to me, that stuff is a massive signal, right? Like, it's, and a lot of people don't even bother to go visit because they're hiring so many people, and I mean, we hired a lot of people, right? Like, right. I joined Jet, it was like 20 people. By the time Walmart acquired us, like a little over a year, late 2016, we were 300 something people. So as you would imagine, to get from 20 to 300 something, we had to interview a couple of thousand people. I mean, that's how high our bar and filtering was. So my point is, I understand that we have a lot of interviews to do, a lot of screenings to do, but I mean, this is so important, this stuff, that you kind of have to chase down some of those rabbit holes. And for me, I would scan through the resume and say, you know, I see you got a project on GitHub. Can I go check that out? Is there? And there would, some people would come alive when you ask them about that stuff, because that's the stuff they really love to do. And those are strong signals to me that this person goes above and beyond. Like, they do way more than just, you know, what you normally sort of see. But I see so many places just ignore that. Like, that's extracurricular stuff. Like, that doesn't matter. Just tell me about what you did at work. And it's like, okay, that's fine.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, this person is doing so much more than just what they have to do at work. And so that tells you, like, where their mindset is and how hungry they are and what they're willing to do. And so I think all of that is incredible. It's sort of lots of fine detail that teases out these other things that I was talking about, work ethic and what kind of human being they are, and you know, so I don't know if that's helpful, but basically I think those are the signals for me that this is going to be a really good contributor. And you know, I had a pretty good hit rate because I've had to let go of very few people, and a lot of the people that I had on my teams, you know, did really well. So I do think those are strong signals, but our industry kind of ignores them, basically. I don't know if that makes sense, but.
True. No, it makes sense, because a lot of people think if they are a good, techie or a developer and no algorithm, that's all is needed. But I am hearing again and again from all the senior managers, they always want to look beyond technical skill, because technical skill is given.
It's the minimum.
By default, have to know how to code, but beyond that, that matters a lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, Louis, if I'll ask you, secret of your success, what is one attribute you can, or one thing about yourself you can say which made you successful? What was it?
You're not going to like this answer, but recently I've kind of become convinced that luck had a lot to do with it, but
no, I agree completely, because yes, I agree.
but you know, not in a sense like lottery luck, but just trying a lot of different things, right, to get lucky. And so I kind of feel like that's a completely underrated thing. I mean, you know, like, for example, we had, just to go back to like the Jet days, I was working crazy hours at Jet. It was a startup, very fast moving, like a rocket. But then I still made time to try my own stuff and go and build something on my own for my own projects and side projects and things like that. And then the craziest thing is, like, something would come up there that then I would be somehow able to tie back to work. And so when I went back to work, I had a crazy idea. Let's try this thing. I would sell the business partner that, hey, I know we're going to build this affiliate program, but let's do it for influencers. Let's just go for influencers first. Let's not bother with these other, and let's build this influencer tool. And so it's like these steps and all this extra stuff, just trying things, kind of led me to do things that ultimately, I would say, made me pretty lucky, you know. But it's just throwing different things at the wall, and then you see kind of, you know, what's sticking and what's working. And I think this is so important. Like, so many people undervalue this, right? Like, if you're not working on the right thing that adds the right value, it's really hard to move up really fast. How are you going to do that? If the project you worked on for the last 2 years fails, okay, you know, you're not going to get fired, but you're not going to get promoted, right? And so to get promoted, I mean, you got to look at the things that matter, and you got to move the needle on it. And that's luck a little bit, right? Because you need the opportunity. But I also think you could build your own opportunities. Like, you could basically try a lot of different things, and you have a say as a, the way we used to run it is, I would tell people, you have at least one third of a say at the table when you are talking to business and product. You can push back, and maybe they can override you if the two of them are against you, but maybe you could sway one of them, and then suddenly you're going in a different direction. If you feel really strongly in your gut saying, like, hey, if we just do this way, we're going to make millions, let's just do this. I mean, as an engineer, you have to kind of be awake to that. You have to be paying attention to that. And so you have to have, I mean, you need kind of the ownership and some of the other stuff we talked about earlier, but basically, just trying different things and seeing that you are not just on this train ride and you're not being taken along somewhere. You could move the train in the other direction, and you know, you could convince people to move the train in the other direction, and then you can get lucky, because you know, if it's obvious that the project is going to fail, you could kind of see it, right? Like, this is not going to generate the kind of revenue. This is not going to do anything. And so why am I still writing code on this? Like, I would say at that point, just look to switch teams even. Like, that's not going to, you know, you need to get lucky. And if the thing's going to crash, you need to be outspoken about it, because your career is on the line. Right. And so I'd say, you know, I don't know if that kind of answers your question. It's definitely not lotto luck, but it's for sure, you know, consistently working on things that kind of made a big impact. And I'd say, you know, it's just a lot of trial and error. And certainly there were some things that failed too, right? But you know, looking back at those failures, I mean, they feel minor because we cut the cord quick, and we just sort of, you know, raised the white flag. Like, we're done with this. Like, let's move to the next thing, because this is it. It's not really going to work. So I don't know. It's a lot easier to do this in a startup. I mean, in a big company, people are kind of set on their ways. It's a lot harder to steer the ship. But even in a big company, I mean, you know, people understand, right? Like, if your project and your feature does not deliver any business value, you're not going to be moved this fast. And so if you tell people that, like, the goal is this, they might just listen to you. And then, you know, you kind of work on, and similarly, they might have their own, and I don't just mean that the engineer knows what the heck to build. I mean, they might have their own reasons. The product team has very, very valuable insights. They've studied the users. They understand the market. There's all these other things, right? And so you listen to those people. And if it sounds like, okay, this is probably a pretty good rabbit hole to chase, you side with that person, not the person that's going to, like, you know, kind of let you just be all off to the side and trucking along on this thing that's set to fail. That's a disaster, basically. You want to work on, you know, you want to try a lot of different things, and you want to try to make yourself lucky. And I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that if I had to pick one thing, the number one reason why I climbed so fast. We added massive business value, like, over and over again. But we had a lot of failures in there. But the failures didn't count because we didn't spend a year on it. You know, they get tossed out the window.
Right. True, true. No, I completely agree with you, because I see even my case and you know, many of our friends. Like, I come from India, where you have, you know, 1.2 billion people. And I was not one of the brightest students. But somehow I got the visa, and other guys, their visa got rejected. So luck plays a very, very important part in life, for sure, I feel. But luck brings you to a place, but to sustain there, it's your hard work. So what I hear from you is just, it's not only luck, but you are very curious too. Like, you had a day job, but still thinking about other problems and trying to figure it out. And then the persistence you showed. And focus, and focusing on the right thing. I think these are the very important thing which I, you know, just learned from you, that you were making sure the thing you are doing is the right thing, putting the code in the right product, or cut the losses quickly. So I think these are the important points. No,
there's a lot of influence that the engineer can sort of exert too, right? Like, you're in the code, you see the code. You know, that counts for something. I mean, you know exactly how long something's going to take versus, so there's like a lot of things. And then you might be able to see something in there that says, hey, we could actually get something, we get 80% of this in like one sprint rather than three or four sprints. You know, little things like that, I mean, they just kind of add up, right? They kind of compound over time, you know, putting you in a position where you could showcase to management that, hey, you know, we've added immense value. Like, you need to grow this team, you need to grow me, you need to, all of those things kind of come together. And so I think luck is involved, but you have a lot of, you know, you're not like a passerby. You have a lot of say, I would say.
True. So Louis, if you remember the best management advice you got in your life?
So the best management advice I got in my life probably is mostly centered around people, I would say. And it's just basically that, like, my mentor used to tell me all the time that people are leaky abstractions. And so even though we have this handshake deal with the business that we're going to go do this, they might change their mind and pull the plug on it tomorrow. And so we need to just be talking to them, and we need to do all these different things that you would normally like not factor in, because if I'm writing good code, if I'm building, that's my job, right? Like, why do I even need to talk to the business or the product or whoever? And so just this idea that even though we're writing code, even though we're building products, people run the world. And basically, you need to be building up your network in your company. You need to constantly keep an eye on that, because it could derail everything you're working on. And so I think that's really important. And you see that, you know, even big, like, So a lot of these FANG companies, like basically Google, and they're built by engineers, and so everybody has, you know, engineers go in there, right? And engineers are very smart. I'm an engineer. I love code. I love computers and all of that. And so they think, okay, this follows a set of rules, and the rules are this, this, this. If I just add impact, I get my promotion. There's no question asked. And then you find out that's not really how it works, right? Because behind the scenes, when they go into these calibration meetings, and when they go into, they're fighting with each other. And so it's really hard to assess whose impact is bigger than another person's and all these other things. And so all these leaky abstractions start coming out. And you know this is true, because even organizations like, I don't know, there was like a whole scandal at Bridgewater a few years ago. And Bridgewater is this thing that's supposed to be run with radical candor and transparency, right? And it turned out that one of the C-level people was like basically caught lying. And then Ray Dalio, the guy in charge, they did a whole investigation, and they have camera, they record every meeting, and they find out that, okay, you know, they were lying. And what, they didn't fire the person. They didn't fire the person. And so what does that tell you, right? That nothing is systemic that way. Nothing is systemic. And as long as people are in charge, there will always be little things that happen. And so you have to keep an eye on people. You have to build those relationships, and don't believe that it's just this, like, you know, A, B, C, and D. I mean, it is largely, but you have to keep an eye on human beings. You have to talk to human beings. You have to build relationships. And I mean, that's also going to help you, right? Like, it's not just about, you know, getting a promotion. It's not just about, you know, it's going to help you become a better developer, a better coworker, a better everything. And so I always used to tell my team that, you know, do the one-on-ones, reach out to so-and-so. You know, they would ask questions like, why, you know, why is the business thinking about, why don't you go ask them? I mean, just Slack them and set up the meeting and just ask, you know, and get to know the person. And I think that goes such a long way. And it sounds like, okay, you might end up in a lot of meetings and things like that. But I think like these meetings, you might have like once a month or once a quarter, and it's 30 minutes of your time. And that's going to go such a long way. If let's say that, you know, your manager is pushing for your promotion, and you have a great relationship with other teams because they know you've done a great job. And now your manager's fighting for your promotion. And then another manager speaks up and says, you know, I work with that person. I know they're very good. You know, that is it. Like, it's going to happen, right? You have more than one person fighting for you. And these are weird little things that people don't, I say they undervalue. You cannot undervalue that stuff. Like, even at Google, I mean, look, even at Google, the guy that ran Android, they had to fire him and give him hundreds of millions of dollars. The whole thing is leaky abstractions. The whole thing is messed up. And so you have to keep that in mind. True. That there will be things that happen that will not be fair. And so you have to just do everything in your power to, you know, your career is your sort of your responsibility. You have to build your network. You cannot ignore that and just be heads down. It's not going to work, basically. And I used to tell my people that all the time. And I hired, you know, very, very smart people that were super heads down. But, you know, I would force them. And they would force themselves. And it worked out. And I think that's a really good, you know, that's a really good piece of advice I got, to just keep an eye on the leaky abstractions. You know, because there's it accumulates.
You know. True. No, it's very good advice. So on the same line, what is the worst management advice you got in your life?
Okay. So I kind of talked about this a little bit. I don't know if I talked about this, but basically, you know, this idea that software engineering is kind of like a factory job, right? That, hey, we're here and we're going to get like our little task. We're going to do our little task. We're going to hand it off. We're going to get the next task. We're going to do that. And there's no room for creativity, right? Like, we're just doing the task and handing it off because that's our job. I mean, it's like an assembly line. And so we're just part of that assembly line, and we're handing it off to someone else to assemble the other parts. And that's just not what it is at all. I mean, it's an incredibly high leverage sort of activity. And like I said with some of the other questions you asked, it basically, like, if you keep your eyes open, the task might be able to be done in 2 hours, or it could be done in 2 months. And you only know that because you're in the code. And so I think this is like an incredible, it's a massive advantage you have being in the code all of the time, because most of the people that you partner with and you talk to regularly will not be in the code all of the time. And so if you think it's just some factory job where you get the task and then you pump it out on the other end, then you're never going to take... You're never going to have any leverage. You're never going to, you know, compound your knowledge and be able to do these things much, much quicker. And all of those things basically lead to you becoming, you know, an amazing engineer and sort of a compounding force for your team and your company. And so I basically felt like that advice that, like, hey, this is just like a factory job, was terrible advice. And I in my gut, I knew, and I was pretty junior back then, but in my gut, I knew it was bad advice. You know, because I saw the work I was doing. I was like, this doesn't feel like factory to me, you know.
I remember there was a book written, I think, somebody from Microsoft, and the book name was called Software Factories. And when I saw the title, I felt the same way as you felt. Like, no, this is not a factory job. It's a lot of creativity there, and you cannot treat the software as a, you know, manual work.
It's not, right? Because, you know, you think about manual work a little bit, right? You think about somebody that's building a wall, and, you know, I love that brick, you build the wall brick by brick kind of metaphor, right? That Will Smith uses it. I love that.
Right.
But, you know, someone can only build a wall so fast, basically. You can only lay, you know, the bricks so fast. But when you're, right, when you're writing a book or when you're building software, I mean, one person could take, you know, and it's not just about speed. I mean, it's about defects, it's about all of it. It's about, you know, how impactful the thing is, how fast it is. It's about, you know, it's about all of those things, right? And so basically, they're nothing alike, you know? And so I think that's really, really, you know, I think this is kind of like the industry. This is no longer the way they used to think like that, I think, years ago. I think now, you know, most of the industry has accepted that this is knowledge work. This is incredibly high leverage. And so I don't know too many places treating developers like factory employees. And if they are, they're probably going to lose them very soon because the market's going crazy. So
true. Yeah. True. So I have last question is about failures. Because people, when we see somebody from outside, we see only the success, the shiny part of someone. And, you know, this beautiful journey that you come, you know, you climb from working in a restaurant to a senior director in a very big company. But people don't know what you go through in between. So I would like to know if you can share any of your failures and what did you learn from it and how did you overcome it?
One sort of failure, I don't know how good this is, but this is kind of like earlier in my career, I basically failed like maybe 10 interviews in a row. And I was in a tough spot. Basically, I had just bought a house, you know, and I was doing a lot of work to it. I was broke. And, you know, we had come from poverty, we're buying our first house, you know, I had a pretty good job, but I needed to make more money somehow. And they weren't giving it to me where I was. And so I went for interviews and but I was so stressed, right? Because I had all these bills and all these different things. And so my mindset going into these interviews was just terrible. And I remember being in one interview and I felt like the people that were interviewing me had a sense that, man, this guy might actually be good, but like, for some reason, he's kind of messing up this problem we're giving him. And so they one place kept me there until like 10 p.m. I mean, they just, like, wow. They brought in person after person. I'm like, what is going on? Like, I just want to go home now. I'm done with this thing. And so I was in a pretty bad spot. I mean, but like 2 or 3 months later, you know, things got a little bit better. I had my father-in-law help me. Personally, things got better. And then, you know, I landed like 3 offers, you know. And so this whole thing goes back to like, the interview process and how it does a disservice to a lot of, you know, great people, basically. And so having gone through that right. and been burnt that badly, I can now see that a lot of people are probably getting burnt that badly. That was a pretty big kind of, I look back on it and I kind of laugh at it now. That's one example. One other example I have is from Jet, where we accidentally pushed out this, and this is kind of, you know, it goes back to this whole idea that, like, you know, after you've pushed some bugs out there, you kind of laugh about them, you know. But I think juniors basically don't laugh about them. They're very scared that they mess something up. But anyway, so at Jet, we pushed out this bug with our promo code engine, where basically someone could use the same promo code over and over. And within 1 hour, the thing was on the internet, on Reddit or something. And basically, like, there was like,
wow,
I don't know, 100,000. And we were a small startup, so there was like $100,000 worth of orders in like, or 150 or 160, I don't remember the exact number, within like a span of like, I don't know, 30 minutes that I introduced this bug. Mm-hmm. and people are like talking about it all over the internet. Like, this is amazing. You could just keep getting 20% off. You just keep using it. But we fixed it. But I remember, you know, I remember how I felt. I mean, I felt terrible. And I had to, you know, I did the root cause and what went wrong. And I, you know, it was a very basic bug, basically. But then I had to explain to the chief marketing officer that I messed this up. But I could fix it. I could cancel every order. Like, I could, you know, I could revert what happened. And she was like, you know what? Don't cancel the orders. We could use the sales. And I was like,
wow.
I was like, oh my God, you know, like, this is, it changed my mindset about bugs, dude. Right? And maybe that was a good thing I did, you know? Anyway.
Right. Yeah. Nice, cool. So, Louis, thank you very much for Absolutely. Your time. And it was very helpful. I learned a lot. I hope our audience learned a lot in this. I really want to recommend that your Timeless Career Advice for software engineers. I'll put the link below. So please go ahead, go through that course. It's about 1 hour course, but it's a lot of wisdom there. And it will help anybody, you know, starting their career, or even, you know, you are a senior engineer, it will help.
Thank you.
So thank you very much,
Absolutely,
Louis, for
man.
Doing
Thank
this.
You. Thank you very much.